This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
I'm Dr. Andre Gomez Suarez, Senior Research Fellow at the Center of Religious Reconciliation and Peace of the University of Winchester. And I'm very pleased today to be joined by Dr. Gwen Bonnet, who happens to be my wife. But more importantly, Gwen is Junior Research Fellow in Anthropology at Merton College, University of Oxford, researching peace, politics, and polarization in Colombia. She's got a PhD in Anthropology from UCL and MPhil in Anthropology from the National University of Colombia. She is member of peace-building organization Embrace Dialogue, or Rodemos el Diálogo, and co-founder and coordinator of the Laboratory for the Anthropology of the State in Colombia. Gwen is author of Chocolate Politics and Peace-Building, an ethnography of the peace community of San José de Apartado, Colombia, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2018. And director of award-winning documentary, Chocolate of Peace, which was published in 2016 and can be seen at www.chocolateofpeace.org. Her new forthcoming book is titled The Face of Peace, Government Pedagogy Amidst Disinformation in Colombia, being published by the University of Chicago Press in 2022. Gwen, welcome. And thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really, really happy to have you here. And, you know, not only because you have a very long relationship with Colombia, and we have a long relationship through that country too, but also because I think that we at the center and our audience can learn a great deal from your research. So why don't you kick us off by telling us a bit about your research with the peace community of San José de Apartado? What would you say we could learn about peace building from that research you did?
Well, thank you so much, Andre, and it's a real pleasure to be here. And it's really lovely to be connecting with the University of Winchester in my own right, no longer only as your partner, but to be able to share my research as well with your audience. So thank you so much for inviting me today. The first book that I wrote is called, as you say, Chocolate Politics and Peace Building. It's about the peace community of San José de Apartado, who are one of the most emblematic groups of victims of Colombia's 50-year armed conflict. They were in a rural area, peasant farmers, campesinos, trapped between left-wing guerrillas, right-wing paramilitaries and state forces. And they decided to declare themselves neutral to the conflict as a way of trying to stay in the lands that they were in and resist forced displacement and also reclaim their right as civilians not to be involved in the conflict. And this was a very sort of creative interpretation of international humanitarian law's principle of distinction. Unfortunately, they were targeted because they were denouncing crimes of the state and because of their history of involvement in kind of left-wing social movement practices, they have been targeted by especially paramilitary and state actors, and they've suffered pretty much all of the patterns of victimization that have been experienced in the Colombian conflict, from mass forced displacement, forced disappearances, massacres, stigmatization, sexual violence in the framework of the conflict, landmines, etc. So they're emblematic for two reasons, I think. One because of all of the things that they've suffered, but also because of the pioneering position of neutrality that they've championed as a way of sort of resisting being involved in the conflict. In my book, what it does is look at how this community emerged in this context of extreme violence and difficulty and lots of different economic interests in their land. And in the midst of trying to protect themselves, they kind of shifted into a longer term framework, which was no longer just about protection, but it was a longer term logic of peace building. And so I really looked at what peace building meant for the peace community. So instead of just trying to protect themselves, which I call a kind of logic of negative peace, the desire that the armed combat should stop, the desire to be safe, be able to go out and work their crops in their own lands, they were really working with a much longer term, more positive peace type of practice, which was based on organizing themselves into groups so they could go and harvest crops together, organizing themselves into an internal council, sort of democratic governance, also organizing themselves in order to generate economic solidarity. And one of the important aspects of the book is called chocolate politics and peace building, as you can hear, is they at the heart of their project of peace building is the cacao crop. So they produce cacao, and they've been organic cacao farmers since long before they were a peace community. And so I look at how that cacao practice sustains their everyday practice of peace building. And I look at how peace building for them also means things like keeping the memory alive of those that they've lost. So they have pilgrimages every year to the sites of specific massacres to remember their dead in a living and lived memory. And re-signifying places of death as places of life and sort of revival and revitalization. And also their relationship to nature, I think, is another aspect of their kind of view on peace building. If you look at the incredible cacao groves, which they keep, they're places of absolute life. You know, the floor is full of kind of rotting husks and insects and dried leaves and all of these other plants that they're growing together with the cacao. And they call that the agriculture of life, which they counterpoint with what they call the agriculture of death, which is the practices that they see going on in Colombia of multinational companies, in particular in the region of Urabá, where they are the banana companies, who not only fumigate their crops, and you can really see in the film, which, by the way, it's chocolateofpeace.com, not .org, as you said in your introduction, you can see that the contrast in the film with the banana plantations, they are kind of rows and rows and rows of very dry, cracked earth where everything is dead apart from the banana plants. And of course, they're also the multinational banana companies have been found responsible for financing the spread of paramilitary violence in Colombia. So they really have a very multidimensional view of what violence means, the economic dimension of it, and they're putting forward a very multidimensional concept of peace building as well.
Gwen, I remember that actually we met when you were in London supporting the peace community from an international NGO. And so I would like to ask you if you could share a bit, what is the role of the international community? What is the international dimension of their project of peace building? Probably that would be really important for our audience to understand.
Yeah, so I first met the peace community before I became an anthropologist. I'm an accidental anthropologist, by the way. I became an anthropologist kind of because of the peace community. It's their fault, I sometimes like to say. I had studied literature, and that was my background. And then I decided I didn't want to be in academia because I thought that it was too much ivory tower, and I wanted to be involved in the real world. So I went to work in human rights, and I ended up in Colombia working in an NGO called Peace Brigades International, which is an NGO that provides unarmed international accompaniment to human rights defenders at risk in conflict zones around the world. And I was deployed with them for 2 years in the region of Urabá, in one of their field teams in Colombia. And PBI has a very unusual and I think extremely ethical mandate in the countries where it works. And you can see this in the example of how they work with the peace community. They are not funding, they are not directing, they're not doing projects. They believe that the people who best know how to build peace in countries of conflict are local people who have local projects of peace building, like the peace community, but whose work is deeply threatened because various actors are threatening their lives. The threats against the peace community are very real. And so by sending teams of unarmed international volunteers to literally walk alongside these people, you represent the eyes of the international community. And anything that you see goes into reports that get sent to foreign governments around the world, that get sent to Amnesty International, you know, all of these different NGOs that kind of are interested in human rights and stuff. So it's a very sophisticated network. And I think this really exemplifies the peace community's attitude to the international community, because the peace community have really resisted the more interfering types of international NGOs. So any NGO that goes along and says, oh, I think, you know, I know what you need to solve your problems, let me finance this thing or that thing, the peace community has just absolutely refused to do, have anything to do with them. The peace community has really, I think, staked out a very, a position of kind of self-respect in the midst of the international community, because of course the international community in Colombia is very multiple and varied, and has done, you know, important things, but has also done a lot of damage in ways that we can talk about later. But around the world, I mean, there's so much scholarship that your listeners don't need to be told about the problems of international community involvement in peace building in conflict zones around the world. But I think for the peace community, it's much more about amplifying their denunciations of human rights violations and standing with them in solidarity. I think they really see it as a human relationship of solidarity, which goes far beyond kind of a technical, legal sort of support, and definitely far beyond financial support, because the peace community is relatively autonomous in its financial functioning.
And beyond the human rights dimension that you mentioned, you have spoken also about chocolate. And so what is the importance of chocolate also thinking about the international political economy? Yeah. Is there something else that we need to understand in order to see the big picture of all the international support that the peace community tries to do?
Thank you for getting me there. Unusually, the peace community has a relationship with Lush Cosmetics, which is a British-based multinational with something like, 1,000 shops in 50 countries or 5,000 shops in 50 countries, I can't remember. It's the shop you'll walk past and smell interesting smells. It's the smelly shop. They are a kind of ethical, kind of activist-y company, or they have their background in animal rights activism, I believe. And so the peace community sell their cacao beans to Lush. When I was doing my research, it was about 50 tons per year, but I don't know how much they're sending now. And Lush uses the cocoa to process it into cocoa butter, and that then gets used in various products like massage bars and soaps and creams and things like this. But they don't just buy the product at a better price. You know, they help the community with the organic and fair trade certifications, but they also are committed to helping visibilize the community's problems. So there was a campaign that I ran when you and I met. I was running this campaign jointly between Peace Brigades International and Lush Cosmetics to raise awareness among the Lush clients in their shops about the peace community's human rights situation, and gathering signatures from customers on a petition to ask the Colombian government to protect the peace community and deliver justice for the crimes committed against them. So this is very much within the framework that the peace community sees the international community in terms of international solidarity, in a way, even though, and it's not, I'm not an expert in fair trade, I'm not an expert on Lush, my research was on the peace community. So, you know, there's lots of criticism we can do to fair trade organizations, I'm sure. But for the peace community, they very much saw Lush as similar to a human rights organization rather than a sort of big bad multinational company like the ones that they repudiate.
That's amazing. So you have somehow in your first research discovered a very interesting, comprehensive approach to peace building by a grassroots organization. And then your next book that is going to be published is actually focusing on a completely different part of Colombia. Because you decided to study the Colombian government, which actually was victimizing, or according to the peace community, was victimizing them. So now that you move into that direction, and without, of course, entering into why you do that, or if you just want to mention it, but the big question behind this is, when you moved to study the government, what did you learn about peace building from this perspective? And your book is called The Face of Peace. So could you explain us also a bit about what do you mean by the face of peace?
Yeah, so after I studied victims of state violence, as you say, I decided to turn to studying the state itself. And there's a field in anthropology called anthropology of the state, which looks at the state as a social world like any other. I mean, the state is a community, and quite often we're not used to thinking about anthropologists studying powerful institutions, but it's actually more and more common to do so. And I think it's really important to look at the state, and in particular the government. The state, you know, the government changes hands every 4 years in Colombia. And when the government changes, they change other parts of the state. So they really have a huge role in any attempt at peace building. And I felt that it was really important to understand what was happening in the community, in the social world of the government, in the Santos administration, which is the administration of President Juan Manuel Santos, who was the president of Colombia, who negotiated with the FARC guerrilla after 50 odd years of war between 2012 and 2016. You know, I think the challenges of doing research on peace building is that quite often it's difficult to get close to those people who are in charge of implementing the policies of peace. And there's a lot of research on grassroots organizations, as I had done previously. But ultimately, you really need to be able to take into account, I think, both bottom-up and top-down processes and people in understanding the challenges of ending a conflict and building peace. So that's why I thought it was important to look at the government. In particular, I did 13 months ethnographic participant observation inside the Office of the High Commissioner for Peace, which is the branch of the Colombian presidency that was in charge of doing the negotiations with the FARC, which took place in Havana, but also for explaining the peace process to Colombian society. So they created a small team called the Peace Pedagogy Team, who were charged with traveling the country during the negotiations and explaining to different audiences around Colombia what was being negotiated in Havana and why, and what the advances were. And this was, I thought, extremely interesting, particularly because in 2016, there was a referendum. The final agreement was reached, and it was put to a referendum, which sadly, which was not legally necessary, and I think was many agree, I'm sure I know you agree with me, was a terrible tragedy, because the referendum lost by just 50.2%, the no won. And you have written the first book on why the no won, called The Triumph of the No in Spanish. So lots of people had analysed after you had, you know, how the no had won. The no won amidst a context of extreme disinformation campaigns by the opposition, not unlike actually the disinformation campaigns we experienced in Brexit here in the UK just a few months earlier in June 2016. So, you know, you analysed very clearly in your book how this had happened, what the narratives of the no were. But everyone in that moment started also to blame the government, to blame the Office of the High Commissioner for Peace for not doing enough peace pedagogy. That was this narrative that circulated in all of our WhatsApp chats at the time, blaming the government for losing its own referendum because they hadn't explained it enough to people, which is kind of based on an assumption that if people just could understand rationally how good the agreement is and all of the contents of it and all of this complexity, it was 297 pages long, it was full of jargon. I don't think even you read it all the way through. I mean, it was absolutely detailed and complicated. If only people could understand, then they would support it, which is just based on an assumption that A, people are stupid were duped, and B, an assumption that the only thing that matters is rational comprehension of what a document says and not hundreds of other things which come into play when it comes to asking a country of 50 million people fragmented across multiple geographies, social classes, ethnicities, political histories, histories of the conflict. When you ask them, do you want to support this particular government's peace agreement? So I thought it was a good idea to go and do research in the team that was supposed to do peace pedagogy and see what they had actually done before the referendum, what they were going to do in the lead up to the 2018 presidential elections, which were widely seen kind of as a rerun of the referendum. And in fact, they were a very successful rerun of the referendum in the sense that the same people who had campaigned against the peace accord won the elections in 2018, and Iván Duque, who is currently president, was their candidate, so he won those elections. And so I was with the team as they were going around the country trying to explain to people what had been agreed, and what I noticed was that they kept talking about the difficulties of giving face, which in Spanish is dar la cara, and what they meant by this was the difficulties of going to face different audiences as the government and represent the government to skeptical audiences in a context of extreme political polarization. And this is because in Colombia there's huge distrust in the state, which goes back decades. It's not just to that specific to the Santos government, but the sort of distrust in the state gets actualized with every new government, and it takes on new shapes and new specificities with the kind of the face of the president and the government in power. And so that's why my book is called The Face of Peace, because I argue that using the experiences and perceptions of these officials who I worked with, who were really agonized at the difficulties of talking to people and saying, look, this is the peace agreement, and really people just saw them as kind of representatives of Santos, and they saw that they really politicized the peace agreement. They saw it as a partisan thing, which of course it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be a public policy. The idea is that Santos tried to convey from his government a face of peace, because he sort of put the whole government to that end, trying to show that he was making peace. But it wasn't really sufficiently convincing because of a liberal attachment to rationality, which is evident in the way that they try to explain things to people. And this fits within the literature on liberal peace as a kind of criticism that I know that a lot of your audience will be aware of. And it adds this strand of rationality as the kind of cultural ideology behind the liberal face of peace, and shows how problematic it is in the context of a country which is mostly not culturally liberal. And, you know, like any society, emotions, identity, and sort of beliefs and values all come into play in the moment of making a decision on an electoral ballot. So that's why it's called The Face of Peace.
I listening to you makes me think about this a quote by John Paul Lederach, which says that the journey toward reconciliation always leads to seek the face of the enemy. So bearing that in mind, did the peace community engage with the Santos administration in this negotiation? What was the face that the peace community saw of the Santos administration? Did they see the face of peace or not? What do you think?
That's a very good question. Now, the peace community were very skeptical of the Santos administration's attempts to make peace. Santos was not chosen by a kind of leftist peacemaking electorate. He was chosen as the successor of Álvaro Uribe, who was the main opponent to the peace process. So a lot of people felt that he was just going to be the same as his predecessor Uribe, but with a slightly more attractive to liberal international audiences sort of discourse. There was a huge amount of distrust in him from the sectors of Colombian human rights organizations and social movements that I had worked with previously. They started to slowly come closer to the government and play a role I would call of critical friends, not being supportive of his economic policy or the fact that he was from a kind of traditional political elite, but they did support the peace policy, the peace process, a lot of these organizations, in particular after 2014 when Santos was re-elected on a peace ticket, and during the negotiations on point 5 of the agreement, which was the point on victims' rights. And the peace community, as an example, were invited to participate in a delegation. There were 5 delegations of 12 victims, so a total of 60 victims of all different crimes, victims of different sides of the conflict, traveled to Havana to give testimony to the negotiating table and offered their proposals on peacemaking. And the peace community was invited as one of the most sort of emblematic groups of victims. And they said no for the first three invitations. So the first three delegations went without the peace community. In the fourth delegation, they did send their legal representative, Herman Graciano, who had lost 13 members of his family in the conflict. But nevertheless, with a certain degree of skepticism as to the utility of this exercise. And I think that that position that the peace community had, which is a relatively radical position, is nevertheless fairly representative of a large swathe of the Colombian left who were just felt that Santos was too far away for them to support. He was too far away kind of ideologically and face-wise, really. So they didn't buy his face of peace, basically. I think they felt that it was superficial and masked, actually, the truth underneath. But, you know, then there were other civil society organizations that did really make great strides in working much more closely with the Santos government to try to help the peace process along. So, which is common. This has happened in many other countries. It's always a dilemma for civil society organizations as to how closely to work with the state, which brings me back to my first point about how important it is to understand the relationship between state and society in a peace process, which is always riven with distrust, and yet it's crucial for implementation.
But you have mentioned the international community. So probably that would be a really good question to ask you in this moment. And is, so was everyone outside Colombia, it seems, says that the international community has been supporting the peace process all the way through. And you were saying that somehow Santos had the face of sort of the liberal peace project. So what has been overall the impact of the international community in the efforts of the Santos administration to give the face of peace to Colombian society, or to do peace building and to do this peace pedagogy that after the signing of the peace agreement meant to start working on implementation of the peace agreement and bringing the FARC together with the communities and explaining to people what it meant to move away from 50 years of war?
Yeah, so I think, as you say, worth remembering that the international community has been, at least at a macro level, extremely supportive of the peace process, has channeled huge amount of money into it, and strategic help as well, technical support from the negotiations to in Havana to the implementation today on the ground. In the giving face from the Santos government to Colombian society, which one of the arguments I make in the book is I think that's really kind of where the whole peace process was, the downfall of the whole peace process, because, you know, Santos put so much effort into the negotiations, but didn't put nearly as much effort into facing Colombian society. But the efforts that he did do, that the Office of the High Commissioner for Peace did do, they were largely funded by international governments, not by the Colombian government itself, which is perhaps indicative of the lesser importance that the government ascribed to doing peace pedagogy and facing Colombian society. And in many cases, unfortunately, the international government and supranational organizations funding these efforts actually ended up producing the opposite effect than the one they were seeking to support. So rather than building trust with skeptical civil society organizations, they contributed to breaking trust down. How did they do this? Well, I document several ways in the book that they did so, including by paperwork, by the contractor system that they actually have, whereby they finance some of the staff in the Colombian government, but put kind of contradictory impositions on their time. But the one I want to mention today is an example of USAID, which is the US government's development program. And they couldn't fund anything where the FARC were present, because the FARC were and still are on the US terrorist list. So this was a peace process where billions of dollars were supposed to be channeled from the US to Colombia, and yet nothing of that could be spent on events in which there was FARC present. And it was a peace process with the FARC. So the whole thing was completely ludicrous. And there was one example of a guy that I that I describe of a peace pedagogy event being organized, and a member of the FARC who had disarmed years before the peace process had been invited and was on the invitation list. And someone from the Office of the High Commissioner had to phone him and uninvite him, apologize, say it was out of their hands. And then the other participants in the audience of the event got wind of this and got very angry and demanded explanations. And this basically took up half of the morning trying to explain this and trying to sort of apologize on behalf of the Colombian government for the blunder of the American government. And in a context of kind of social movements who are already deeply skeptical of the Colombian government and its involvement with what they call US imperialism, this really just added kind of fuel onto the fire. So I think that the international community has a lot of responsibility in the failure of the Colombian government to adequately give face and convincingly build a shared understanding of peace with Colombian civil society.
Well, this is fascinating. Unfortunately, we will have to finish very soon. I would like to ask you a final question that is a challenging one, but probably you can give us one hint. And is, you know, you've looked at grassroots organizations, you've looked at the government, you've seen the ambiguous role that the international community plays, sometimes in favor, sometimes against. If you were to give us one tip for a pedagogy for reconciliation in divided societies for the future, what would you think that could be that tip?
I think one of the most important things is, as I've been mentioning, the role of government-society relations. So the government needs to be involved in going out and facing society and building genuine relationships with different sectors of society, but they can't do it on their own. One of the things that I saw in government peace pedagogy sessions was it was too difficult for people to overcome their distrust in the government when the person talking about the peace process was a representative from the government. What worked much better was when events for peace pedagogy, for workshops or talks or whatever the kind of form that took, were co-convened and co-facilitated by the government representative and a member of a civil society organization. It would have been good for the Colombian government to have done more joint work facing society together with the FARC, which they felt unable to do because they saw the FARC as the undesirable other of the peace process. But I think that it would also be important to consider speaking from the same hymn sheet. I did see one peace pedagogy session where there were members of the FARC speaking alongside the government, and this was after the disarmament phase, and it was extremely powerful because it didn't matter if people remembered the details of point 3, point 4, point 5, or the acronym of the state organization in charge of XYZ. What really mattered was the symbolic power, the ritual of seeing the government and the FARC together on the same panel saying, we are going to do peace. We might see things slightly differently, but we're committed to building peace and we're committed to doing it without violence. And I think that the power of ritual in peace pedagogy for the reconciliation is really a very important thing.
Gwen, thank you so much. I mean, with this that you have said about the FARC and the lack of engagement sometimes of the government with the FARC, I think brings me back to the quote that I read of Jean-Paul Lederach, because no doubt that when we are going to do a government or we are going to do pedagogy about reconciliation, the first thing probably is to see our face in the face of the enemy, to try to recognize the degree of humanity and the sameness between those who were our enemies in the past and with whom we have to build a future together. It's been absolutely amazing to have you here. I hope our audience enjoys this podcast.
It's been a real pleasure. Yes, I look forward to hearing future podcasts and hearing more about the work of the Centre.